Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Justin Wall versus the state of Texas. And may it please the court, Ms. Lisa Mullins to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Victoria Ford to argue for the state.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lisa Mullen for Mr. Walls, who represented himself pro se in his murder charge. I'm appointed on the appeal. And first, I'd like to thank y'all very much for the opportunity to talk about this case, particularly point of error number one, which is what I'd like to focus on. Excuse me. From this jury charge error, I hope, or at least I thought when I read the actual charge, a moment of astoundment that this charge would be drafted and allowed to go to a jury in this particular case in this fashion. It's deeply disturbing when you really consider the true letter of the law and how the only legal defense in this case, the self-defense, was charged only to the benefit of the state. Was charged in such a fashion that there was absolutely no vehicle that the jury had when reading it to apply the law of self-defense to the for the defendant. Surely we can't allow this in our justice system. I'll just start there. The law of self-defense, I think, is clearly erroneous, and I think the state's conceded that in their brief, so I won't waste any time on the fact that it was error that occurred. The defendant was pro se. He did have standby counsel. However, neither objected to this jury charge. So it went to the jury with absolutely nothing to show how they could apply self-defense in this case, the only legal defense in this case, because the defendant had conceded every other element of the offense, that he did it, that he shot, that he was there, identity, location, everything was conceded because it was a self-defense case from the moment it occurred, from the very moment after he left the scene. He never fled the area. He just went home with his grandmother. The police contacted him, and he immediately began saying exactly what happened from his perspective.
And egregious harm is the standard.
Correct. That's, yes.
So tell us what the egregious harm was. Okay. Explain that to us.
Egregious harm vitally affects a defensive theory. The law is replete and long, and for how many years? That says if there's egregious harm occurs in a case where it vitally affects a defensive theory.
So explain how that occurred here.
Well, there's three ways that we look at that, right? The first one is the charge as a whole. So when you look at the charge as a whole, one, we had absolutely no vehicle for a jury to say self-defense equals this, not guilty. There's nothing in there that says that. So that's the beginning. The second part of that, from the jury charge as a whole, is that it actually ended up being a comment on the weight of the evidence given the charge that was given, because it says basically if you find the defendant did not, then you will disallow the self-defense issue. So it was all a converse charge in favor of the state, which my argument is when you read it, it basically says it's not there, it's not there, it's not there, therefore you're not going to find in favor of the defendant on self-defense. It also shifts the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on the state. And if you read the one paragraph, all it says at the very end is then you must find against the defendant on the issue of self-defense. It doesn't say in any regard that the state is required to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. It places no burden, and in fact, it shifts the burden to the defense in the case, which cannot be allowed under our law. Egregious harm, I mean, I think it's replete in this particular case. So that's the jury charge as a whole. Let me see if I missed anything.
So your argument is the nature of the error itself is what caused, is the harm, not the state of the evidence, the rest of the evidence out there.
I'm saying we've got to consider all three, but all three equally. But the charge, the state of the evidence, and then the argument of counsel are the three things we consider in an egregious harm assessment. And I'm just saying the jury charge itself, we've got a comment on the weight of the evidence, we've got a shifting of the burden of proof, and we've got absolutely no way for a jury to give any kind of consideration to the only defensive theory in the case. So when you go back to what egregious harm, if it, and the quote is directly, vitally affects a defensive theory. Doesn't mean that there has to be beyond a reasonable doubt self-defense if the jury charge vitally affects a defensive theory. I don't think there's any argument in this case that it doesn't. Based on the charge, now we turn to the evidence. The second consideration in an egregious harm assessment. The evidence in this case from the very beginning showed self-defense from the defendant's perspective. I understand that the state's perspective was not that, but from there was a lot of evidence throughout this record of self-defense proffered by the state. His first statement to the police officer, to the detective, took responsibility, explained the self-defense. He was being held in the room. The guy wasn't letting him leave. That he was in fear for his life. That is stated over and over again, not only from the defendant, but also from the only witness that was there.
So what was the evidence that the victim was allowed to, or excuse me, the appellant was allowed to use deadly force because there was a need because of the immediate use of deadly force by the victim? Because the victim right. said, I'm going to hold you, you're my insurance policy, I'm going to take you to this meeting.
Right.
What was the immediate need for deadly force on the part of the appellant?
Charging him and saying, I'm going to snap your neck. There was testimony that showed that he was in fear for his life because the guy said, well, I'm going to hold you for insurance, and to me, for gangs, means a threat to kill. And secondly, when he says he was in fear because he said, I'm going to snap your neck, and he came at him.
But the physical evidence did not really support that, did it?
I do not think it negates that at all. I respectfully disagree with that. The detective actually testified that it was certainly possible that the complainant was coming towards the victim or the defendant at the time the incident occurred. There's no forensic evidence, which the state carries the burden to prove, that it wasn't self-defense. There's nothing that negates that, and in fact, there's physical evidence that shows that he was by the door. The victim was by the door. If you look at the crime scene photographs, where he was actually
blocking the door, though, was he?
He wasn't blocking, but that's coming from an area which would block the door.
And rather the trajectory of the bullets would have meant that the victim had to be lower than the appellant, correct?
Depending on how everybody's situated, I don't necessarily agree. Whenever we start talking trajectory and downwards trajectories and how they are meant, it all depends on the body positions of the people involved. That's why the detective said it would very, very possible that the complainant or the victim was going towards him, and if he was down, going to get him in that fashion, then it's very plausible that the trajectory would back up a self-defense argument.
Well, if he was down, he wouldn't be going for the guy's throat, would he?
Well, he could be going to grab him around the barrel. He could be going towards him like this in this fashion. I mean, the problem is there's a million different ways a body can be situated. And so when we talk trajectory, we've got to be able to have placement of the bodies. Or it's a push either way. The other issue that I thought goes to show the fear is that even the witness had told the detective, the only witness, as he testified at trial, he said along the lines of, oh, I just went to go to the bathroom, which certainly doesn't sound very insidious in and of itself. But what we find out later is that he's told the detective that he was ordered by the victim out of the room, which is very, very important. And then he concedes finally that there's a discussion of gang, there's a discussion of insurance policies, all going to a self-defense issue in this case. The grandmother, we had other witnesses that also said he was in fear for his life. The emptying of the gun, shooting it 6 times, indicative of somebody that obviously is in fear. You shoot once maybe to kill somebody, but if you're truly afraid, you're going to keep shooting until you can get away and avoid being harmed. And the motive. I know, obviously, the state is not required to prove motive, so I'm not going in that direction. However, it's a logical consideration when you're looking at the self-defense issue and the evidence. And in this particular case, these guys were friends. They were smoking weed and drinking all day. They were hanging out. Actually, the complainant is the one that went and got the defendant to come over to hang out. There was absolutely zero motive for anything to go south for any kind of killing to take place, an intentional murder, other than the possibility of self-defense in this particular case. So I think the evidence clearly bodes in favor of egregious harm or showing towards egregious harm, because there's a lot to work with from this case. In that regard, the third one is the arguments of counsel. The defendant was pro se, so his argument obviously focused on his defense, which was self-defense. However, he never referred to the charge, not being a trained litigant, as to how to apply that. So that's a push as far as negating any kind of harm or tempering the egregious harm that occurred, didn't mitigate it at all. The state, however, had the ability and did cash in on the lack of a self-defense charge, because she pointed to the one paragraph that's in the jury charge, which basically says, then you find against the defendant on the issue of self-defense, and argued very directly that this guy's completely confessed to murder, he's admitted to every element of the offense, so basically he's guilty, because that's what we have in this charge. Once he says that he admits to killing and doing the act, when there's no vehicle in a jury charge to apply self-defense, then he's basically guilty and it's over. And that's exactly what this jury was left with in this case. And nothing in the jury argument militated or negated or helped the fact that the correct charge was not in there. The state never stood up and said, we carry the burden of disproving that. We carry the burden to prove you, and we've done that. That was not the argument. The argument was, here's the law, the judge has given you the law, and the law says basically fine against the defendant for self-defense. Just on another note, the disturbing nature of this jury charge I don't think can be overstated. We're in a position where the judge accidentally, obviously not intentionally, instructed a jury to find against self-defense, basically. As a purist of the law, which I am, I love the law. I believe it should be applied accurately in every case. For justice, we all go. This can't be countenanced, certainly, under our law. And the egregious harm standard is a high standard. And I know, as a defense litigant and an appellate counsel, I worked on the Court of Criminal Appeals, it's a hard standard to meet. But if there's ever been a case that meets it, it's this case. This is patently unfair. And I'm telling you, we can't be allowing this to occur. And one of the things that actually occurred to me, having been a prosecutor for a number of years here, how a prosecutor allows that jury charge to go to the jury without objection. We're supposed to be seeking justice as prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges. Why wouldn't somebody stand up and say, "Look, this needs to be fair. This application must be in here in the correct way in order for justice to be served in the case," even though this guy's pro se, representing himself, and obviously didn't have the wherewithal or knowledge to object to it. Based on that, I'm asking for this court to reverse this case on this egregious error in the jury charge. If you have any other questions, I'll give you a few seconds back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Victoria Ford, and I represent the state in this matter. The state asked the court to affirm appellant's conviction in this case because the jury charge error did not egregiously harm appellant. As opposing counsel focused solely on the first issue, I'm going to do the same. The state recognizes under Barrera v. State that the failure to instruct the jury that if they have a reasonable doubt as to the issue of self-defense, they are to acquit the defendant. And that is error, and that is what occurred in this case.
I have a question about that. In light of counsel's last comment about how does this charge ever get submitted, you know, what are the rules which govern prosecutors with respect to submitting a proposed charge which is patently, by both sides, erroneous?
Well, from my understanding, the way charges are drafted in Tarrant County here, the court actually creates the charge and the parties review it and then say whether they have objections or not. So from my understanding of the procedure that's done in Tarrant County here, it was just something that was missed. And it has happened in plenty of cases before, which I'll speak of in my argument, that this the statement, if you have a reasonable doubt as to in the defensive theory here, that you must acquit, it does slip through the cracks sometimes.
But that's not the only thing that was wrong with this charge. I mean, we're supposed to look at the totality of the charge, and it does submit a converse instruction concerning self-defense. I mean, if you were to take the charge here and compare it to the criminal pattern jury charge, it's completely different. Not only that, but this charge had retreat language in there. Retreat, that hasn't been the law for a decade. So this charge as a whole, it's more than just not giving the instruction that the state has the burden to disprove or else the jury is to acquit.
Yes.
Would you agree?
Admittedly, yes. This charge is not ideal. It's not what we hope to see, and we hope that jury charges are correct in the law and the jury is correctly instructed. However, we do have this harm analysis to allow us direction of what to do when these errors do occur.
But when this is really the guts of the defense case, is self-defense. It's not, did he pull the trigger? It's nothing else. This is the sole issue that the jury's being allowed or being asked to decide. Doesn't that make an error in the charge more egregious?
It's based on the four factors that we look at in Almanza. And in Reeves v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals stated in 2013 that an erroneous instruction will not necessarily be harmful even when it's on the sole defensive issue. In that case, it was a stabbing, and the defendant admitted that he stabbed the deceased, and his sole defense at trial was was self-defense, and in that case they were looking for some harm because the appellant did object at trial, and they did find some harm, but there was no objection here. And I would like to remind the court that appellant was pro se at trial. However, he chose to proceed pro se, and he was admonished of the dangers of doing so. He had standby counsel who he conferred with throughout the trial. That's on the record. And in Johnson v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that pro se defendants are held to the same standard as an attorney who would represent them. They must be aware of the technical rules, and they're supposed to give no special consideration. So although he was pro se, we are supposed to review this case as if there was an attorney there that could have objected, and the fact that he was pro se does not minimize the fact that there was no objection.
So the fact that this is a not uncommon error, which includes attorneys making it, does that not apply equally well to him?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. And the state of the record, again, even if there is find that there is some harm associated with the jury charge, that does not diminish the light that we have to view the other factors, particularly let me first touch on the party's arguments. Opposing counsel mentioned that the state did argue the self-defense in closing argument, and that's true. However, the argument was confined to what the self-defense charge is. The state's prosecutor did not talk about the burden really at all, and really just talked about how they should view the evidence, whether or not it was reasonable. And in Allen v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals held in 2008 that when the state merely talks about what the self-defense is and not how to apply the standard, then that factor is neutral. So the party's argument is rather neutral, and I think that the bulk of the or the crux of this case really is the plausibility of the defense's theory. Again, in Allen v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that it's appropriate to consider the plausibility of a defense when reviewing for egregious harm. And in that case, the court did hold that the party's arguments and the jury charge as a whole weighed in favor of finding harm. However, the plausibility of the defense, in that case, it was consent for an assault, of whether the victim consented to being hit, whether that was likely or whether the jury would actually be able to find that even if they were given a correct charge. And the remoteness of that charge and the fact that it was so unlikely that the jury would find for that, the court held that they could not meet the egregious harm standard, which was also the standard at play in that. In Allen, that the consent issue was the hotly contested issue. It was the issue everyone was battling about. Likewise here, the self-defense issue was the main issue at trial. However, that does not make that the error egregious, as it was in Allen. We can use the Allen court, suggest that we must review all of the evidence and view whether or not it was a plausible defense. Appellant's self-defense argument.
What does plausible mean?
Whether or not the jury would buy it, for all essential, to put it.
Do they have to buy the defense, or do they have to conclude that there was a reasonable doubt about the defense?
It was whether or not the jury would really go for the, whether they would find in favor of the defendant on that issue. So whether or not they would find the appellant not guilty based on the defense.
So in other words, whether the state met their burden of proving lack of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the instruction that was excluded.
Correct. So appellant's self-defense argument essentially was that the deceased, Stephen Scott, was a member of the Texas Syndicate, and that he intended to use appellant as an insurance policy, and that he stated, appellant stated that Scott would not let him leave the house, that Mr. Scott tried to tie him up, he had hit him on the leg, and that after Mr. Scott allegedly said that he was going to snap appellant's neck, appellant then shot him. And there was some inconsistencies in appellant's story. He first told the detectives that Mr. Scott was going to stab him, and then he changed it that he was going to snap his neck. So that was a inconsistency that was presented to the jury. The state's evidence rebutted appellant's defensive theory, making it very unlikely that the jury would have found in favor of appellant, even if they were correctly instructed. Miss Phillips, who's Mr. Scott's wife, testified that appellant was the only person with a gun in the house. The detectives who worked the crime scene confirmed that there were no other weapons found within the room or on the deceased himself. Mr. Christian, who had spent the day with appellant and Mr. Scott, testified that the two had argued throughout the day and that appellant was the more aggressive out of the two, that appellant had brandished his weapon multiple times throughout the day, leaving it out on the bed as well. And Mr. Christian did not recall any discussion of the Texas Syndicate or threats made by Mr. Scott to appellant. And he testified that Mr. Scott was simply not trying to keep appellant in the house whatsoever. The Crowley Police Detective, Joshua White, testified that the direction of the bullets did not indicate that Mr. Scott was blocking the door. As Justice Gabriel, you pointed out, the trajectory of the bullet also showed that appellant would have been over top of Mr. Scott, which goes against appellant's theory that he was being attacked and coming forward. Detective White also testified that the Texas Syndicate is a primarily Hispanic prison gang, and Mr. Scott, as a Caucasian male, would likely not have any interactions with this gang. Again, as I mentioned, Detective Scott pointed out the contradictions in appellant's self-defense story, whether or not he was almost stabbed or whether his neck was almost snapped. And there were no injuries to appellant, particularly on the wrists, where he said that Mr. Scott had tried to tie him up throughout the day. Additionally, the state presented 911 calls made by appellant, and the second one was, it seemed as though he meant to call his grandmother, and very calmly, right after these the murder took place, where he allegedly was in fear for his life, he said, hi, Grandma, I'm ready to be picked up. I'm at Carl's house. Paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was a very calm demeanor that he was calling his grandmother to come pick him up. And the weight of this evidence together rebuts appellant's defensive theory, really in almost every way. In Villarreal versus State, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that lack of evidence of self-defense in light of the state's evidence can substantially outweigh a finding of harm. That's what the state believes happened in this case, and what the court, we put forward, the evidence does substantially outweigh a finding of harm in light of the fact that the harm standard is egregious harm, and it must be a showing of actual and not theoretical harm, so not maybe this would happen, maybe not. But given the evidence that rebuts appellant's defensive theory, it is so unlikely that that the jury would have found in favor of appellant on that issue. Even if the jury were to believe appellant's version of events, the record does not support a finding that the defendant's use of deadly force was immediately necessary to protect himself against Mr. Scott in this situation. As I mentioned, appellant argued that the deceased made verbal threats to him and then hit him on his leg. And this court has held in Bundy versus State that verbal threats and a punch combined are not sufficient to warrant the use of deadly force. Appellant was faced with...
But he said the guy was coming at him and was going to choke him. Did he not say that?
He said it was the verbal threat and that he might have been coming at him. Again, charging someone is not the use of deadly force. There was no weapons found on Mr. Scott or anything like that.
There's something about a cable in the room or some sort of instrumentality that he could have been going to use to choke him?
Appellant did make that argument that there was something in the room that could be used to tie him up and choke him. Again, Detective White noted that was not likely the case. There were some cables, I believe, found outside of the bedroom, not in the bedroom, that could have been used, but again, they were not right there immediately necessary for appellant.
So if there's one in the pictures in the room, where did that come from?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm mistaken then. But again, given the positioning of appellant and where Mr. Scott's body was found, it's just not likely that that is actually what was happening in this case. And given the facts of this case, as shown on the evidence that I've just explained, even if the jury were properly instructed on the issue of self-defense, it is so unlikely that they would find it. It is a remote issue that appellant has not shown, the record does not show that there was egregious harm in this case, and therefore the state asks the court to affirm appellant's conviction and overrule that first point of error as well as the second. Thank you.
I don't have much to add, if anything, unless the court has any other questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, we really appreciate your argument here. It's been very helpful to us. This case is now submitted, and you're free to leave. We have an argument again at 10:30, but we're going to take a recess until that time. Thank you.
All right.